Please rise. Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely, counsel. My name is Jan Van Emmerongen. I am here on behalf of my client, Donald Cole, with respect to this appeal. We have raised three issues in our appeal. Issues two and three certainly appear to us to have been decided by this court in July in connection with the Johnson versus State decision of July 1st, 2005. As I indicated to opposing counsel prior to the session beginning this afternoon, I was going to advise the court of that and indicate that I am prepared to proceed with argument with respect to what was our first argument in the case relating to Mr. Cole's statement that he gave and the use of that statement by the police.
I take that to mean that you're not going to ask us to readdress the issues that were decided in Johnson.
That's correct.
Okay.
Briefly, with respect to the facts, although they have been set out in both briefs, Mr. Cole was in the middle of a trial as a defendant in connection with attempted murder charges that occurred in Lancaster Avenue in the city of Wilmington. He had a co-defendant in that trial, Elwood Hunter. Mr. Hunter was identified during the course of the trial by one of the victims of that shooting, and in fact, Mr. Hunter was claimed to have been one of the shooters there at that time. Mr. Cole, on the other hand, had not been identified by any witness specifically as having been there. However, Mr. Cole, during a recess, told his trial attorney at the time, Brian Bartley, that he had a moral imperative to make sure that Mr. Hunter, who was not involved in that crime, was not convicted of that crime. He advised his attorney, Mr. Bartley, that he would be willing to plead guilty to the attempted murder charges and make a statement to the police about who was really involved in that Lancaster Avenue shooting in order to make sure that Mr. Hunter was not wrongly convicted of that charge. Mr. Bartley strongly advised Mr. Cole not to do that. Mr. Bartley advised Mr. Cole that the case against Mr. Cole had not been as strong as the case against Mr. Hunter and that he should proceed to trial. Mr. Bartley also advised Mr. Cole that because the state had information linking the Lancaster Avenue shootings with a double homicide that occurred 9 days after those shootings in terms of ballistic evidence which linked the two crimes together, by admitting his involvement in the attempted murders, he would, in essence, be giving the state information about his possible involvement in the double homicides on 23rd Street. They discussed this, and Mr. Cole advised Mr. Bartley, well, he needed to at least make sure that Mr. Hunter was not wrongly convicted. Mr. Bartley suggested to him, well, perhaps if you make a statement about both incidents, we can get the state to take the death penalty off the table in the double homicide case. So Mr. Cole authorized or instructed Mr. Bartley to approach Mr. Miller, which is what happened. Mr. Bartley approached Mr. Miller. Mr. Miller controverted that Mr. Miller told Mr. Bartley right up front, I don't have the authority to do anything like that. It, a question such as that has to go before the senior staff in the Attorney General's office. Mr. Miller was able to set up a meeting of the senior staff for the next morning. However, the trial was continuing in the Lancaster Avenue matter, and they were not able to, I guess, complete that meeting. However, Mr. Miller testified at a subsequent hearing in this matter that he was not authorized to make any such deal that would take the death penalty off the table. What ended up happening is that Mr. Miller and Mr. Bartley had some conversations. Mr. Miller was advised by the senior staff that he needed to get a taped statement. Mr. Cole agreed to make a statement to Detective Chapin, who was the chief investigating officer, and Mr. Miller, with Mr. Bartley present. But unfortunately, whatever other agreement there was not reduced to writing. There was no agreement in writing that in exchange for your giving this statement, you will get X, or that by giving us this statement, we will only do A, B, and C. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. If it had, I doubt that we'd all be here discussing this issue right now. But in the context of what happened, he made the statement. After the statement was made, there were communications between the two attorneys about what was going to happen. Mr. Bartley testified at a hearing in connection with this case that he thought, as soon as the state corroborated the statement given by his client, Mr. Cole, that the death penalty was going to be taken off the table and that they would proceed only as a murder first with life option as the sentence, Your Honor. Mr. Cole had given this statement implicating himself and two other individuals in the 23rd Street shooting and one of those other two individuals, Mr. Johnson, in the Lancaster Avenue shooting. Detective Chapin, shortly after the statement was given and after the senior staff had met, asked Mr. Miller, well, does this lock us in to Cole? And we found that out at the hearing in connection with the motion to preclude the death penalty. And Mr. Miller told him, no, it doesn't. You can go out and continue to investigate. So, Your Honor, one of the key contentions here is that Mr. Cole believed that this statement was only being given to the state so that the state, for one purpose, could look and see whether or not they should take the death penalty off the table. He was not aware that the state would be using this statement to gather evidence against him for a subsequent trial, if that was what was going to happen. He was not aware that they would be acting upon his statement to play it, certainly, to any of the people that he had named. And in fact, they played portions of this tape to both Mr. Norton and Mr. Johnson. After Mr. Norton was played the tape, and he had counsel present, he made himself a deal to flip, if you will, and testified against Mr. Johnson and Mr. Cole. Without that statement that implicated Mr. Norton, the state did not have any information that Mr. Norton was involved. Mr. Miller, at the motion to preclude the death penalty, had said that he was among the possible suspects and that his name had come up, but when Detective Chapin, the chief investigating officer, was on the stand, he said Mr. Norton was known to us as somebody in the area who was known to Mr. Cole, but beyond that, they had no information about Mr. Norton's involvement. Furthermore, the screen that was admitted at trial was left at the scene for a year, Your Honor, and was only found after Mr. Cole made the statement indicating that that was the point of entry into the home. They didn't know if it was the front door or the back door or a window until Mr. Cole's statement. With respect to what happened, we have Mr. Cole thinking that he's going to be getting something in return for the statement. If we want to parse the statement into two pieces, he admits his involvement in the Lancaster Avenue attempted murders, and as a result, he then later pleads guilty, and Mr. Hunter's charges are dismissed, or they're not processed by the state. That's one thing. Then we have what he did is he had implicated himself directly with respect to the statement of the 23rd Street double homicide. Now, Judge Del Pesto had found against Mr. Cole with respect to whether or not there was an agreement prior to that statement in the motion to preclude. Fortunately, the jury had recommended life and Judge Del Pesto sentenced him to life after his conviction, and therefore the issue has not come before this court in connection with that motion. But the subsequent motion that we filed was to exclude the evidence that was garnered by the state and by the chief investigating officer as a result of that statement. One of the very first things that Mr. Miller says on the tape, because again, this wasn't reduced to writing, so we have to look at what was said at the tape, is the deal right now is that we are going to take a proper statement of what you have to say about anything we ask you about, and I'm going to take that statement back to my superiors and discuss with them whether to make you an offer where you would be spared capital punishment. Do you understand that? And the response is yes. He doesn't say in there that we're going to do that, but we're also going to use it to get more evidence against you and build a case against you and seek the death penalty against you.
And what is the significance of it not saying that?
Well, in light of, Your Honor, two other portions of the statement, immediately before that, Mr. Miller, in essence, advises Mr. Cole in a shorthand way of his Miranda warnings, not the formal way that I'm sure you have all seen in a form that a police officer may have. He says, Mr. Cole, we're going to, based on the conversation that your lawyer and I had earlier, take a statement from you about a number of different alleged crimes. You understand that you have the right to speak or not to speak, and you have the right to an attorney. He is, in fact, present, correct? Well, he doesn't actually advise him anything about whether it's going to be used against him or not used against him. But when you turn to the very end of the statement, he specifically says, we're not going to talk about this with Sticky, who is Elwood Hunter, or Larry Johnson, or anybody else. And he says, we'll terminate this, and I'm going to go back to my office and do what I told you I was going to do at the beginning of this interview, i.e. take it back and discuss it only with the senior staff.
And he says that at the end of the interview.
Well, yes. He says, confirms it at the end, that what we're going to do is what I told you about in the beginning. Just take it back. And he says, we're not going to talk about this with Sticky or Larry Johnson or anybody else. I understand what you're saying, but listen, while this is still ongoing, there's a reason why we want to do that. The less people that know about it, the better. And he says, we know what you're saying to us, and we're going to hold up our end. Well, if there was no deal, and Mr. Miller thought there was no deal, then what end is there that we're holding up?
Well, the state's suggesting their end is to go talk to the senior supervisors about whether to seek the death penalty.
Well, the state would have it that that was the limit, I guess, of what their agreement was. That all we're going to promise is that we'll consider it.
Well, let's go back to what you said originally. Unfortunately, there is no written commitment on part of both sides, no bargain for a contract about what was going to happen if he made the statement he made. So tell us what is the law that you suggest should apply and that would preclude the state nonetheless from doing what they did and the fruits of doing what they did being admitted in trial against your client. It sounds to me like you're suggesting that one of the evidentiary rules, Rule 410, should have an exclusionary rule of some kind attached to it.
No, Your Honor, actually I was just arguing the rationale behind 410 because the research that I had done with respect to 410, not necessarily just in this state but in the federal research that I had done as well, indicates that absent something to the contrary, 410 only limits the use of something in trial. It doesn't limit something for investigative purposes, which is...
And the policy behind it is to encourage settlements, and in this case, encourage plea bargain. We all understand that, but
correct.
What would prevent... What is a matter of law puts you in front of us?
Well, it's a matter of law that puts us in front of us is that the state, in this case, it's our contention that the state didn't just limit themselves to 410, that the state, as is evidenced by Mr. Miller's comments here, and as is evidenced by at least Detective Chapin not being certain about what was being done, that what they were saying is there is only one purpose that we're using this statement for. In another context of a hypothetical, if...
Well, you're losing me here.
Okay.
Probably my fault, but...
Probably isn't your act.
Explain to me in as simple enough terms that I can understand it, what as a matter of law precludes, in the absence of a written agreement, the state from using your client's statement in exactly the way they did?
Because whether or not there was a written agreement, if there was an agreement and detrimental reliance by my client in giving the statement based upon the agreement, then the state must be held to the fire of that agreement, Your Honor. They can't then just say, we were kidding, we're going to seek the death penalty against you. Instead, what they have to do is do what they said they were going to do, and if they don't, then there should be an exclusionary rule for that.
But there's nothing in the record of them saying, we will not do this, this, and this with this.
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, Mr. Bartley did not respond immediately to the email correspondence that Mr. Miller sent to him following the statement being given. Mr. Miller sent an email later that day or the next day confirming what had happened that day, and then some time passed before Mr. Bartley emailed Mr. Miller and told him, it was my understanding you weren't going to use this for any investigative purpose, at which point Mr. Miller immediately responded, no, that was never what we agreed to. So I do not have Mr. Miller ever stating under oath that there was an agreement. I do not have a written agreement, but what we have is an affidavit from Mr. Cole with respect to what his understanding was. What we have is the statement itself And to the extent that we look at that statement, and the statements are from Mr. Miller himself, although not clear-cut saying, this is what I'm going to do, the inferences to be raised from that are that there was an agreement that the only thing that we were going to use this for was to see whether or not you get the death penalty.
Perhaps this is an oversimplification, but it sounds like you're arguing to us on a matter of equity about us drawing a line between legal and illegal sandbagging. Your client was sandbagged. We can agree to that. But what is illegal about the way in which he was sandbagged that would rise to the extent of reversing his conviction because evidence was admitted that should otherwise not have been admitted?
Well, Your Honor, I think two things. One is the detrimental reliance argument, is that he acted as he did in good faith upon what was being promised to him, and it was not delivered. The second is, if we look at his statement itself, and we did not file a motion before the trial court challenging voluntariness, Your Honor, and I'm not able to tell you that we did to preserve that issue necessarily. However, if part of voluntariness and looking at the totality of the circumstances and determining what is a voluntary statement is, did the person understand and know what they were doing and why they were doing it? If in fact he was induced to give a statement based upon his understanding that there was an agreement, well, then that becomes an involuntary statement as well.
Well, but isn't the record as consistent with him understanding that his statement would be taken to the superiors in the Attorney General's office to determine whether or not it would continue to be a capital case or not, with no thought given to any other use of the statement, as it is with, I'm limiting the basis for my statement to you simply taking it to your superiors to make a determination about whether this case will continue to be a capital case? It's sort of open-ended, isn't it?
It is sort of open-ended, Your Honor. However, I think at A54 in the appellant's appendix is the statement at the conclusion of the formal statement by Mr. Miller, in which he indicates, we're not going to talk about this with anybody.
But by then, your client had already said what he had to say.
But by then, he was confirming what was the understanding before, or at least what was set forth at the beginning.
But he's not agreeing to that today, that that's what he meant.
That's correct. Mr. Miller isn't agreeing to that.
And he didn't agree to it by email when he was challenged about it.
No, he didn't, Your Honor.
But that's why I referred to it, perhaps gratuitously, as sandbag.
Your Honor, whether we call it equity or call it, it doesn't pass the smell test.
But even, you've got to help me out anyway. Maybe my colleagues have already figured it out. But even if everything you say is correct, and we were to interpret the record exactly the same way you do, and that we are aghast at what happened, just for the sake of argument, what can we do about it as a matter of law?
Well, I think what we would do about it as a matter of law is to eliminate the state's use at a retrial of Trevanian Norton as a witness, of any other evidence, including the screen that was obtained as a result of their getting that statement.
Now, was there a factual finding by the trial judge as to what the agreement was?
The trial judge, in connection with the motion to preclude the death penalty, found that there was not any agreement to preclude the death penalty prior to the statement. With respect to the suppression of the evidence, she found, that there was no agreement.
How can we overturn that?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to the detrimental reliance argument, quite frankly, perhaps you're going to need to find that that was an abuse of discretion.
I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish the answer to Justice Ridley's question.
If the court is inclined to consider the voluntariness argument, which I recognize is just being mentioned here for the first time, that is something that I believe is of such a constitutional magnitude that this court could review the record de novo and rule on that.
At the risk of getting kicked in the shins surreptitiously, it sounds like you're arguing that there was an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing here in this agreement, that had your client known
at the time he agreed to make the statement, that more use of it was going to be made than to take it to the superiors for the purpose of reviewing the capital case status, he would never have made the statement.
I think that's true, and I think in the affidavit, which he submitted in connection with, well, it was actually submitted by previous counsel in connection with the motion to preclude the death sentence, he said that it was his understanding that with respect to that penalty, it was going to be waived, otherwise he never would have made the statement. I realize that's not exactly what Your Honor has just said, but at that point, they were filing it in connection with the motion to preclude the death sentence.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Berger, Justice Richler, may I please the court. The state agrees certainly that the second and third claims that have been raised in this appeal are controlled by the previous decision of this panel, and that stare decisis is the applicable legal principle. Turning to the remaining issue, the first issue that's been raised regarding Donald Cole's taped statement, there were some factual conclusions that were reached by the trial judge, and I think those are appropriate. Or factual conclusion that's at the heart of this matter is that the only real agreement between the parties here before Donald Cole made his taped statement was simply, as Mr. Miller, one of the trial prosecutors, expressed at the beginning, was that after the statement was taken, he would take it back to his superiors at the Attorney General's office. They would review the statement, and then they would make a decision whether or not Mr. Cole would be prosecuted as a capital defendant or a non-capital defendant in the homicides that occurred on 23rd Street. There were actually two different shooting incidents here. The first one that Mr. Cole was on trial for at the time he made the statement was an incident that happened on Lancaster Avenue, where two individuals were shot, both non-fatally. And then the other trial that's at issue here is the trial regarding the 23rd Street, which was a double homicide there. Both of the cases were somewhat factually similar. There was break-ins and shootings of the people. The only difference was the ultimate result, and that two of the victims on 23rd Street were fatally shot. The agreement was very limited in scope. The subject matter was simply that once the statement was taken from Mr. Cole, it was approximately a one-hour tape-recorded statement, that it would be taken back to Mr. Miller's superiors at the Attorney General's office. They would review it, and then ultimately a decision would be made as to whether or not Mr. Cole would be prosecuted capitally or non-capitally.
All right, let's stop right there for a minute and help me figure out what would have been going through the defendant's mind at that time if he were told that was the purpose of taking the statement, and he then gave the statement. Then at the conclusion of the statement, counsel would have us conclude that Mr. Miller's statements suggested that they weren't going to show it to anyone else, which they say implies that that reaffirms the totality of the agreement at the very beginning. What's the significance of any expectation the defendant might have had about other use other than taking it to the superiors for the purpose of reviewing the capital status of the case?
Well, I'm not sure what the defendant's expectations, if they're unilateral, in effect, would have. As the saying goes, wishing doesn't make it so. The way you would normally negotiate this, if you were the defense counsel and you really were seeking to limit the scope of it, is that you would request that the state agree to what's called use and derivative use immunity. And I think that's the argument that's really being made here, is that the subject matter of this agreement was a grant by the state of use and derivative use immunity, but that's not what was ever articulated, and I don't think it can reasonably be inferred here. Even the statements by the prosecutor at the very end that he's not going to question any of these other people who've been identified by Mr. Cole during the course of the statement as potential suspects either in the Lancaster Avenue shooting or the later shooting at 23rd Street. That does not mean that there's not going to be any investigation, simply that Mr. Cole's statement is not going to be reviewed with these people, at least at this time, while the state makes a decision whether he's going to be prosecuted capitally or non-capitally. Ultimately,
was that commitment kept?
Was that commitment kept?
Yes.
They weren't going to...
Mr. Miller said at the end of the statement, was that he did not use it in the way he said he would not use it?
I think so. I don't know that the record, is explicit on that. It looks like this is resolved in January of 2003 when the trial takes place. Mr. Cole pleads guilty of some of his pending charges concerning Lancaster Avenue. Others are nulliprost. All the charges against the co-defendant, Mr. Elwood Hunter, are dismissed, and I think that was certainly one of the major impetus for Mr. Cole giving the statement. All the evidence had been concluded at the trial at that point in time, and the way it looked, April Charles, one of the shooting victims, as the judge points out, had emphatically identified Mr. Hunter as one of the shooters, so Mr. Cole was concerned that an innocent person was going to be implicated. In fact, looked like he was going to be convicted by one of the shooting victims, and Mr. Cole knew that it wasn't Mr. Hunter who was with him, it was Mr. Johnson, who was his co-defendant at the other trial. Mr. Cole was sentenced on Lancaster Avenue charges, I believe, in March of 2003, and it's not until September of 2003 that Travion Norton, Larry Johnson, and Mr. Cole are even indicted for the fatal shootings at 23rd Street. So I think on that basis, at some point, Mr. Norton's obviously interviewed by the police. I think Mr. Johnson is, I don't know if he's interviewed, but it certainly Mr. Cole's tape statement is played for Mr. Johnson. I don't know if that's pre or post indictment. I'm not sure about the dates on that, but there is some time lag here. So I think the state did what they said they were going to do. Admittedly, it's very limited.
Can I interrupt on that point? And I realize I may be going a little bit astray here, so I won't take a lot of time with it, but are we agreed that Mr. Cole was told that in exchange for giving this statement, there would be consideration given by the senior staff of removing the death penalty from any possible trial against Mr. Cole, right?
Yes,
you
that's
told
correct.
That? Okay. And would it be fair to say that that assumes that the state was going to act in good faith in terms of reviewing his statement and deciding about the death penalty?
Yes, I think you can certainly imply good
okay.
faith.
And so he gives this statement, which apparently was truthful, confirmed and corroborated and led to the convictions of others as well. And then the state says, sorry, we're still going to go for the death penalty, right?
Yes, and ultimately it was prosecuted as a capital case.
Okay. What was it that the state did that's consistent with its agreement? I'm sure that some meeting took place, but what would have resulted in the state taking it off, the death penalty off the table? I'm having problems with what the quid pro quo was here and what was given and what was offered, in the sense that I don't see where the state did anything for this guy after he gave his statement. And I'm wondering, what was it about his statement that when the senior staff got together, they said, well, yeah, he did cooperate and he did assist us in pursuing these criminals, but we're not taking the death penalty off the table.
Well, I don't know exactly what happened at the meeting as to why it was ultimately prosecuted as a capital case. Ultimately, Mr. Cole did not get the death penalty.
I know.
So even if, that was the agreement, he hasn't been prejudiced by proceeding as a capital case. He wasn't sentenced as a capital defendant. He was sentenced
as a non-capital. And I understand that, and that's why I say I realize I'm going astray a little bit. But I guess I'm concerned that there was really no mutuality here, that there was nothing that the state was giving.
Well, they weren't giving
including any good faith consideration to removing the death penalty.
Well, I don't know that we can go that far as saying there wasn't any good faith consideration. I think all they promised to do was consider it. Whether it was going to result in it being a non-capital prosecution or a capital prosecution, that was simply up in the air. But the other benefit that Mr. Cole did realize from this was that Mr. Hunter, all of his charges were dismissed, and I think that was really the impetus at that late date for Mr. Cole to finally be forthcoming about all this. He's gone through the whole trial, and this is a trial with him and Mr. Hunter, and I guess he thinks, well, somehow we're going to get through this and escape the net. But April Charles, one of the shooting victims, gets up on the day before this statement is given and says, Mr. Hunter, he's the one that shot me. And Mr. Cole's sitting there thinking, no, it wasn't Mr. Hunter, it was Mr. Johnson. Now I've got to do something or Mr. Hunter's going to be convicted. Mr. Cole, there was evidence placing him at the scene. His fingerprint was found near the entryway. In addition, there was the ring that was taken from April Charles, and in the Johnson appeal, we discussed that. That was one of the issues raised in Johnson's appeal, but not this. And there was evidence that he was in possession of the property stolen from April Charles, the ring, and in fact, they even went and got an appraisal of it.
Well, you've established that Mr. Cole is Sidney Carton, and this is far finer thing than he's ever done before when he saved Mr. Hunter. But at the end of the statement, a far, far better thing than he'd ever done before. But at the end of the day, Miller says to him, we're not going to use this statement for any other purpose. Now, whether that's gratuitous or, as the defense suggests, that reaffirms what was the original agreement in the first place, that the statement would only be used for the purpose of reviewing with the senior staff whether the case would continue to be a capital case or not. Justice Ridgely asked you, and somewhere in your answer, I think your reply had to be, no, we didn't fulfill that commitment, if it was one. We did, in fact, use it exactly the opposite of what we told him we were not going to do. What is the legal significance, if any, of that?
Well, I disagree at one point. I don't think he said that they were never going to use it. What he said was they were not going to interview any of these other people about the statement.
But that's exactly what they did do. They even played it to him.
Well,
that turned that person into a witness against Mr. Cole, didn't it?
Well, turned Mr. Norton certainly into a witness, yes.
And is it or isn't it exactly the opposite of what Miller represented would not happen?
Well, then I guess you get back to how you interpret what he said. And I think what he's saying here is we don't want any more people than absolutely necessary to know about this statement. There's only four people present when the statement's being given. So we're not going to talk to any of these individuals you've identified about the statement. And we're going to take this back to the senior staff.
Was Mr. Norton one of those that he's identified?
Yes.
That Miller represented, we're not going to talk to him about it?
Yes. And they're not going to talk to them about it because they're going to go back to the senior staff and make the statement available to them, and then they're going to make a decision whether it's going to be capital or non-capital. And that's really the sum total of what the agreement was here. It was not an agreement for use and derivative use immunity, which is what Mr. Cole is now trying to argue. The state never agreed to
it. What are the formality requirements for use immunity? Is there a rule or statute or anything that requires it to be in writing as opposed to oral?
Well, unless the statute of frauds applies, I'm not sure. But you want something when you're talking about contractual analysis, and contractual analysis is what is used in these plea bargain agreements are considered to be contracts, and they have to show detrimental reliance that you were deprived of the benefit of the bargain. But before you ever get to any of that, you have to show what the subject matter of the contract was here. And as the trial judge found, and her finding is based on competent evidence, and it's not clearly erroneous, she heard all of these people testify. There was actually a two-day evidentiary hearing about all of this where everybody testified, including Mr. Bartley and Mr. Miller, about what was going on after the fact. And her finding was simply, well, that's all the state agreed to. It wasn't much of an offer, but that's what they were doing. And Mr. Cole, even against the advice of counsel, went ahead and gave the statement. The state did dismiss all the charges against Mr. Hunter. The state also complied with Rule 410, since Mr. Cole did not testify at the 23rd Street double homicide trial. They didn't introduce his statement at trial. And the only real question is, well, this derivative use question, could that statement then be used to get Mr. Norton to testify, which in fact he did. His testimony was very incriminating against both Mr. Johnson and Mr. Cole. But that's what you have to bargain for if you want use and derivative use immunity, and that simply was not the subject matter of this particular bargain or agreement. It was very limited in scope, and the state fulfilled what was required of the state in this particular instance.
So in essence, if Miller's comments at the end of the statement were related to the trial judge, as they've been related to us today, she concluded that they were simply gratuitous comments made at the end on which Mr. Cole could not rely, and they were not part of the original bargain which induced him to make the statement in the first place. That bargain was limited to the theoretical reconsideration of the capital status among the senior staff.
Well, I think that's certainly one reasonable conclusion. The other conclusion...
Well, is that her conclusion?
Well, she doesn't say.
She hasn't addressed that.
No, she doesn't address that. But
should we find significance in Miller's representation at the end that he's not going to use it derivatively, whether there was a bargain for him not to use it derivatively or not?
No, because it's after the fact. I mean, he's whatever reliance he had, he has to show detrimental reliance. This is a contract analysis situation. The detrimental reliance is what are you relying on at the time you make the statement, not what you were told post statement. You know, that simply doesn't matter at that point, whatever Mr. Miller may have said.
I guess the difficulty is that your opponent suggested that statement at the end was a reaffirmation of what Mr. Cole understood at the beginning was the purpose of making the statement, that it wasn't simply limited to reconsideration of the capital status of the case.
Well, that's simply an ambiguity, but what's in Mr. Cole's mind, what he subjectively thinks, unless that can be quantified as somehow an agreement that both parties agree to at the same time. You don't have any mutual meeting of the minds.
Well, I'm going to make Justice Berger feel even better about thinking whether she was going a little bit off by mentioning good faith and mention again to you, do we, if this is a contract analysis, think about the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing and imply that had Mr. Cole known at the time he agreed to make the statement for the consideration of capital status, that the statement that he made would be placed before other people as an inducement for them to testify against him, would he have made the statement? Would any reasonable person have made the statement? And then had that crossed his mind at the end of the statement when Miller said, that's certainly not going to happen, should we be troubled by that? I don't know whether A, we should be troubled, but even if we are, what we could do about it, but is this an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing situation?
Well, certainly if this was a commercial transaction, it would be.
Well, it was an open contract.
Right, and I think to a certain extent the contract analysis is applicable. That's how Santabello and this court in Shields analyze these type of situations. Whether you go on to warranties and all sorts of other things, implied covenants, I don't know. The U.S. Supreme Court in Santabello didn't have to reach those kind of issues. But here, I think it's what was the subject matter of the agreement, and the state did comply with that. If Mr. Cole was really concerned about all these things, why was he going and identifying Mr. Norton in another fatal homicide? You know, why didn't he just say, well, yeah, I was there at this other homicide, and yes, I shot those two people, and leave it at that? But he didn't. You know, he was the one who identifies all these people. So I don't think he's obviously that concerned. He's concerned with making sure that Mr. Hunter is not wrongly convicted. And he's hoping to save his own life by getting an agreement from the state that after he gives a statement that they'll prosecute him non-capitally.
But
and that's all he was concerned
with. Isn't the extra, if you will, the extra information that Cole gave part of him trying to show the state that, see, I'm being really forthcoming, I'm telling you all this extra stuff because I want you to take the death penalty off the table. And so he was relying on the state when he did that, otherwise he wouldn't have given extra information that he didn't have to.
Well, it wasn't much of a bargain for agreement, and I'm sure that's why his attorney told him not to make the statement. The state wasn't offering a whole lot up front. All they were saying was, well, we'll consider it. They're not promising that if he gives a truthful statement, he'll be prosecuted non-capitally. That was never the subject matter of the agreement. I'm certainly sure that's what defense attorney would have hoped for, but he couldn't get that type of promise from the prosecutor. And nonetheless, even against his counsel's advice, Mr. Cole went ahead and gave the statement.
Is there any implication that have a condition that the state was going to hold this statement up to the light and look at it and test it based on other information or attempt to corroborate it?
Well, there's some language later on, or statements later on, about they were inquiring as to whether or not the matter had been determined yet by senior staff, and I think Mr. Miller's response was, well, they wanted cooperation. Senior staff wanted to see if it could be corroborated or not, just to find out if Mr. Cole's telling the truth or isn't telling the truth.
Well, showing it would part of that process involve showing it to other potential defendants?
Well, I think that's certainly one way to start. I mean, one of the ways you can find out if something's true or not is ask the other people and see what they say. And Mr. Norton, who was arrested on some other charges at the time, I think when he realized that, oh, no, Mr. Cole has now implicated me in this, and I didn't really shoot anybody. I was along for the ride and fired one shot in the air. Now I'm potentially facing a death penalty. You know, that was certainly made explicit, at least to Mr. Norton, I think. If there's any additional questions, I'll try to answer.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. Unfortunately, you just used up your time, but you used it well. We'll stand adjourned.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. Court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.